In this episode, you are going to get a front row seat to the incredible Springbok career of former national team captain Bobby Skinstad. Bobby, welcome to Front Row Rugby.
Thanks very much, man. Nice to be here. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
So, Bobby, you were actually born in Zimbabwe. Tell us how it came to be that you ended up in South Africa.
Well, I was born in what was Rhodesia, and my dad was an active serviceman. So after the war, they were politely let out the back door and sent on their way. So we came down to South Africa in, I think, about 1980, maybe end of 1980, 81. I'm trying to think. My brother was born here, and we'd been here for a bit. So, in 1980-ish, we came down. My dad's a doctor, so he was active in the war, but then he came down and joined the practice initially in Cape Town and then moved to Durban. So I followed as a youngster.
So tell me how you felt in 1997 when you ran onto the field for the Springboks for the first time against England at Twickenham.
Wow, great privilege. I mean, I was part of a great domestic Currie Cup side, and obviously, you know, was very keen to be part of you know, what was a Springbok side that was resurgent. I mean, we'd had you know, 95, and then a bit of a dip in 96, and then back again 97. So super excited, super proud, and very privileged to be part of it.
Let's go into 1998. You were pretty much part of the replacements bench, but coming on all the time, really, away from home in the Tri Nations. Memorably, we beat Australia and New Zealand in their own backyards. But I want to talk about the first match back. It was in Durban at Kings Park. We're 23-5 down against the All Blacks. There's less than 15 minutes remaining. You come on, you score one of the tries, and we famously beat them 24-23. Talk to me about that occasion.
It's amazing, you know. I can still remember almost every bit of that game. I made a mistake the first time I got the ball. I tried to do an offload, an over fancy offload, and I lost the ball. I was so cross on myself. I made an assist tackle that should have been a full tackle myself. There were a couple of other things that I wasn't happy with, but I was lucky. I came on directly at halftime, and it was a heady time for me. I mean, it was an amazing team. You know, I couldn't really force my way into that team because we had Gary Tashman at 8 and Andre Fenter and Rusty Erasmus were the loose forwards. So, you know, they were set in their positions, playing incredible rugby on a great run of wins. I was just happy to be part of the squad, actually, to be honest. You know, I think there were a lot of people saying, oh, we must be frustrated on the bench. But, you know, I wasn't at all. So I was enjoying myself. Obviously, you want to play more. I mean, that's the conundrum, isn't it? You especially those days, I think Mallet had started, maybe that's the influence that Rusty has taken on to the next level. But he started to understand that the bench was important to bring on, you know, different players at different times, etc. I don't think he quite had the same foresight as Rusty's had, but there's been less time to look at the game. But he certainly was groundbreaking in his thinking. And I was lucky enough to be part of that. So usually the guys have set an amazing platform. It's physical. Position are tiring a little bit, and if you come on with fresh legs, there's an opportunity to do something. So I was very lucky to be able to do that.
And then the week thereafter, beating the Wallabies at Ellis Park, I think that is what cemented your place as a famous Springbok. As I recall, receiving the ball in the back line, playing the dummy pass, slicing through that Aussie defense, the dive behind the posts as well. Discuss for 25 marks.
Well, I mean, to be honest, you know, it was quite, like I said, it was a The memory was fresh in the mind from what was Kings Park in those days. And I think we had enough confidence. Adrian Garvey scored a fantastic try early on from a driving maul. And the team had basically started to get into a pattern of being able to be physically confrontational, you know, without just sort of brawling it. If you look at some of the replays now, it's mind-boggling how much was going on off the ball. You know, luckily there weren't as many cameras or even cell phones, I suppose, around those days. But you know, Kings Park or Durban Stadium atmosphere had been incredible, and then this just went up at a different level. I mean, you know, when people are in that stadium, we know it from 95 and the World Cup, and it's, you know, it's had many different names over the years, but the old Ellis Park, which has become, you know, Emirates Park, etc. It's an incredibly enclosed environment. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of it's very imposing for opposition. The anthems are loud. The fans really, really, really get behind the team. So it was an amazing thing to be part of. And then, just like Durban the week before, because I think everybody was buoyed. The spirit, we see it these days, when the Bucks win, people stick around. They want to celebrate. They want to be part of it. They almost want to just stand in the atmosphere a little bit longer. So we had that. And I remember we had the prize. I don't think anybody had left by 40 minutes later when we did the prize giving for the Tri-Nation. So it was an amazing experience.
And then just your try, I want to focus on that for a second, the tongue out celebration. Tell me about that.
Well, I wish I could tell you that it was on purpose, but it certainly wasn't. My mum used to say when I was bowling in cricket and I took a wicket, I stuck my tongue out. So it was just the natural thing that I did. I've got no idea why I did it, but it was all over the newspapers on the Sunday morning. So I think I got known for it, while not having done it that much. I certainly stuck my tongue out when I was tired, and I was tired by then. It was a fast-paced match. I used to stick my tongue out in the sevens matches. I've seen some old videos of that as well. But in sevens, I was ex always exhausted because the other guys are faster and stronger than me. And that try, I've often said, I was very lucky. Stephan de Blanc ran a lovely inside line, which gave me the opportunity to throw a dummy. But I'm famous for one little try there. The guy that I actually dummied and went through was Tim Horan. And Timmy's become a close mate of mine. And I think I've looked at every match that he's ever played. I think he only ever missed one tackle, whereas I missed many. So I can't claim anything over him because he scored greater tries than me, and he certainly didn't miss any tackles. I think we were just lucky we got him on an off afternoon.
Yeah, he really was a magnificent player. Bobby, if we move on to the 98 end of year tour, even though the Springboks were still winning, it was clear that there was something not quite right in terms of the performances. I've had many former Springboks on this show and I've asked them about it, and some say it was end of year fatigue. Some of them say that Nick Mallett had actually had a change in attitude towards the players. I'd be keen to hear what your take on it is.
That end of year tour was a tough one. As a South African public, we put quite a lot of pressure on the players and the representatives of the country. I remember we went and played against Scotland and beat them quite convincingly, but it wasn't good enough. It wasn't good enough for us, and it wasn't good enough for a public. And I think the public had started to sour a bit towards Nick. Which was sad. I thought Nick was a fantastic coach. Famously, Nick is his own biggest fan, but that's okay because that's Nick, if you know what I mean. He's not a bad person, I don't think. I think he's a very good pundit. I think he's a very good coach. And I certainly think he's a good-hearted rugby man. But I do think it was a heady time. He was suddenly top of the world, and he was sort of maybe caught up in that a little bit. And I think you're almost ready to trip up, which is unfortunate, because when you don't see it yourself, the fall is a lot harder. And I think that put pressure on the team. I think Gary Tashman was feeling pressure because he was a little bit older. Myself and a couple of the young loose forwards were starting to say, okay, well, what about starting positions? How do we do that? I played in the midweek games. I was man of the match both of the midweek games, and you're sort of saying, well, hang on, are we going to get a bigger position? I think the forward pack at the time were very close. I think they were very strong characters. I don't think they wanted to change anything. And I think all those factors coming together created a bit of a perfect storm, if you will. I've never written a book. I don't really see any value in my version of the truth, because I read a lot of books, and I think they've been conjured up in someone's mind, as opposed to laying out what happened. But if I did, I would talk about that time as a really difficult time for me. I started against Scotland, and we had we had a good victory. I didn't feel that I was accepted into the starting lineup of the team. I had a what you call a twisted colon, which is a stress induced I don't know, affliction, if you want. My dad's a doctor, and him and the team doctor at the time diagnosed me as having that, and And I didn't even know that you could get stressed from having fun, type thing, if you know what I mean. So it was definitely a stormy, difficult time with some amazing players doing amazing things. So it was hard to understand.
And you talk about people making stuff up or conjuring stuff up, whatever the case may be. Let's move on into 1999. I told you before we began that I grew up in Cape Town myself, so obviously Western Province and the Stormers. And 99 was a very exciting time to be a teenager in Cape Town with the Stormers. The Men in Black era had just begun. You were the captain. The team was doing really, really well. And then it was something that was very unfortunate for you in that you suffered an injury in a car crash. There's been all sorts of rumors about what actually happened there. I've got the opportunity to ask you now. Can you tell us what really happened?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've said the nice thing about the truth is it never changes. And I've said this a thousand times. We played probably the best rugby match I'd ever played in my life. Was we played against the Canterbury Crusaders, and we gave them a hiding at home. They weren't in form, but they were a very good team. And we smashed them, I think 45-22 or 45-20, I can't remember. And it was a funny game because it was a Sunday game. And I went into their change room again, probably a little bit like the end of the tour. I was in a good spirit. I believed in the good of everybody. So I went in and wanted to have a beer. It was a very morose change room. But I said, look, a friend of mine, Joel Stransky, started this pub many years ago. Another guy owns it now, but it's called the Green Man, and we've got them to stay open for you. I know it's a Sunday night, but you're welcome to join us there. And they went in and they basically locked the change room door and had about 1,000 beers to self-heal after a crushing defeat. And we did the same in our change room, but probably in a celebratory way. We went out that night. I had my brothers and my new, not my new, but my girlfriend, who then became my fiance and 20 years later is my wife, with me, and Justin Marshall, who's become a friend. So, like I said, my story's never changed. Was rude to her, and used words that I didn't enjoy. And I'd been given a new car by my agent and a dealership, which was a Ford XR6 Falcon, which is the fastest saloon car in the world at the time. Stupid in my hands because I'm terrible with cars. And I decided to leave the pub as opposed to make a scene of it. And I said to my girlfriend, and she actually took my brothers and herself back home, or back to my place. And I drove in the car on my own and crashed the car into the Claremont Bridge. So I probably, out of frustration, drove too fast. I skidded, the conditions weren't great, and I skidded into the bridge, and I broke both of my PCL ligaments when I lifted my knees up on the dashboard. And I got towed back home. Obviously tried to keep, as much of it under the radar as possible. Unfortunately, when you do that, a million people, someone said Justin Marshall kicked me in the knee. Someone said that it didn't happen in a pub. Someone, I mean, I've heard all of them. Don't worry. I've heard I was having affairs with my fellow teammates, wives and girlfriends, and I was in the wrong part of town. I've heard them all. Don't care. It was difficult for me. It was a difficult time. But the injury happened, and then I probably got rushed back into competitive rugby too early. And then that created a bit of a stir and a mix-up with Mallett and the 99 World Cup.
Speaking of the 99 World Cup, what was your reaction to the news that Gary Tyshman had been dropped?
Well, I mean, one, I never thought that he deserved to be dropped. I think what happened was the public sort of thought it was, him versus me. And I never played number eight in those days, competitively, with Gary, because I would come on at a different position. So I wasn't replacing him. For the Springboks, we actually played together. I think Nick Mallett had probably decided at the end of year tour beforehand that he wanted a new person in that position. And then, unfortunately, with the accident, he stuck to his gun, so he didn't change his mind. So that's what created all the hype and the trouble. Gary felt hard done by. He had an old group of players with him at that in that Sharks team who'd been around. This was their sort of comeuppance, their moment in the sun type thing, and he probably felt, well, I know he felt that it was the wrong decision. And he's probably right. I agreed. I mean, I've never picked myself to play. He said that he, you know, I got unfair sponsorship from one of the coaches, Alan Solomons, in the team who had Mallet's ear. You know, Solly ran the trainings and he was the Stormers coach at the time we were successful. So if he backed me over Tosh, you know, that's his business. And the news was then that I was in the team. Joost then became the captain. Joost didn't want the burden of captaincy. So I think that, you know, there was no physical problem with that team. We just had a leadership problem. You know, we had Henry Honeyball, who had a torn hammy. They picked him anyway. He didn't play at the World Cup until later in the tournament. We had Brendan Fenter, who got a red card at the tournament, stood on someone's face in a bout of fury. You know, all these people can point at me or Tosh for having made a leadership decision, but everybody's got a little decision on the on the journey. And I really feel that we were at at an early stage of the resurgence of South African rugby, and we probably needed less ego and more leadership on on my part, on everyone, on a lot of people's part. And I think that that's unfair.
How much of a sucker punch was that defeat to Australia in the semi-finals?
Oh, it was, I mean, I don't know if you've watched the game, but Tim Horan had a man of the match performance that was like a Lazarus moment. I mean, he'd been in bed for 4 days. With a stomach bug, he came out and played the best game that I've ever seen. You know, I mean, he sliced through between Rossie and myself at the back of the line out once, you know, created a try. I think he scored another try. And then, to be honest, we were in the game all through extra time and then one long distance drop goal. You know, you lose a semi-final to a 65-yard drop goal, and we're South Africans, so we see it as a fan, a complete and utter disappointment. But so do I as a player. So I can't blame anyone. You know what I mean? It was a massive disappointment. I hated that. I mean, I was part of a loss. I don't like losing. Never have.
Bobby, let's move on to 2001. I know you didn't play in 2000, not for the Springboks at least. In 01, Harry Viljoen, he's the new Springbok coach. He was appointed, of course, at the end of 2000, and he's made you the new Springbok captain. How proud of a moment was that for you?
Yeah, it was an amazing moment. I was very lucky. I mean, Harry backed me as a young player when we'd been playing at Western Province. He carried on with that success, or his coaching career success, and into the books, and picked me. I look back on that period now, and I feel that it just, you know, the it just started piling up more and more, because then you get picked as captain, and one of your best mates doesn't want you to be captain because he wants to be captain. So I mean, I'm looking back now with very fond memories of a career that I suppose had huge highs and huge lows. You know, that was one of the huge highs, and it was a great privilege.
And then in the Tri Nations that year, I mean, I've always thought that we were pretty decent that year, right? We beat the Wallabies, who were the world champions at the time, at Loftus. So you'll remember that that occasion. We drew against them away from home. We should have beaten the All Blacks in Cape Town. You'll remember it was one of those days where Percy just really struggled with the boot. And then obviously, okay, we lost away from home. But what is your assessment of the team in terms of how strong it was at that stage?
Yeah, I think it was a good team. I think, you know, if I look back now, we had probably some selection issues. We didn't quite have the fully integrated resources that we have at the moment. You know, we had a lot of old white guys who'd been in the team and then suddenly retired, and then we had sort of some younger white guys, and then we had the government come in and say, well, actually the team needs to look different. So we had people who were just picked because of color, which was awful. I mean, you know, awful for them, awful for the team, awful for the situation, but it was true. I mean, the government have said it, and South African rugby have said it. I think, you know, one of the things that I say as many times as I can is that, you know, in business, overnight success takes 20 years. And I think it happened to the Springboks. You know, so 1995, you know, 20 years later, we're in a position where potentially we can look at our team now and say, well, the integration plan is starting to bear fruit. It certainly hadn't started in 95. It probably started in maybe 98, 99. And then look at what's happened 20 years later. We win in Japan and then we win in France. So I think that bears testimony to there was some really hard work behind the scenes. And we had a lot of talented players who were rushed. I think of really good players, Wayne Juli's, Conrad Jankies, Janji's. I mean, Conrad was an incredible rugby player and cricketer. But he was taken from a school team to playing in Currie Cup to suddenly the star of the Springboks. And he had one or two performances where he was the star, but the pressure folded him more than anything else. He stuck around for a while, but certainly not to the extent that we might see a Sasha or someone who comes through, gets looked after, gets supported, it creates the empathetic environment. And that's hard. That's hard to bear as a skipper, as a player who's in that environment. We look back and I feel that was a really turbulent, difficult time. But you have to go through those times. You have to go through those times to accept people coming through. I mean, we had some great times, some great people. But if I look at that team, I look now from the outside in and I see where the flaws were, what the cracks were, and which probably then we papered over and now we've cemented over, which makes a big difference.
Let's move on to 2002. Rudolf Strauli is now the new Springbok coach. And you can correct me if I'm wrong here, because I don't have my notes in front of me for my own bad reasons. If I've got it right, you were the captain for the first test against Wales, and then Corné Kricher was the captain for the second test against Wales, and then he continued as box skipper. Can you tell us what actually happened there?
I don't really know. I think Rudolf was trying to play us up against each other to see. He Rudolf came from a military or police and military background, and was quite a closed book as a coach actually. And I think he tried to play Corné and myself up against each other. He thought that was to his advantage, which sparked a lot more than that, and which I think was very detrimental to the team at the time. But what he used to do is he used to start with Corné as captain and then take him off at halftime and ask me to captain in the second half. So, I closed out 80% of the games in that year. I don't think it was a very clever thing to do, but I can understand what he was trying to do, and probably failed in terms of uniting the team.
In 2003, Bobby, you only played the one test against Argentina. How disappointed were you to miss out on the World Cup that year?
Yeah, I was very disappointed. I mean, in exactly the same sort of line of thinking, Rudolf asked me to play a warm-up game. I'd broken a rib against Australia away from home. He sent me overseas as a skipper with no one of any of, I mean, with a completely different team. And then we lost to Australia. We actually started quite well and almost beat them, and lost to New Zealand. And I broke my rib in the Australia game. And then he said, "Okay, I need you to play a warm up game." And I broke my arm in the warm up game, so I missed that World Cup. And I was disappointed, but it was an awful World Cup to be part of. I mean, the Springboks didn't look disjointed, and the I think the leadership was lacking. And I've said it before. I mean, I like Rudolf. He's a nice guy. I think his leadership style lacked honesty, and that's really difficult. Unless you're honest and upfront, people can't get to know you, and certainly can't get motivated to follow you.
You're not the only former Springbok that has told me that, Bobby. So, 2003, like you say, a terrible World Cup from our point of view, perhaps a good one to miss, actually. 2007, you were back in the picture, but you didn't feature in the 4 years in between. Just tell me exactly what it was that happened there.
Not for 4 years. I went overseas. I played in Wales for a little bit, and then I basically retired from professional rugby. I thought to myself, I hadn't enjoyed myself in about 4 years. So I went overseas. I played amateur rugby for Richmond. I started working at Saatchi & Saatchi, started doing well, managed some global accounts. And then I was always available for Barbarian rugby, which I really enjoyed. And then James Fleming, who's a physio, great guy, really great guy, was, he saw me. In fact, he came a visit to me one day and he said, "What are you doing? Why are you not playing professional rugby?" And I just said to him, "Well, I was a bit fed up with it." I said, he said, "Yeah, but I watched you play the other day for the Barbars and you beat England at England and you started at number eight and captained the side and you haven't played for 3 years. Like, what's going on?" And I said, "Yeah, well, I probably wasn't enjoying it as much as I used to." And he actually got me fit again, and I think made some calls, because then I got a call out the blue from the Sharks coach, Dick Muir, and he said, "Come back and play professionally for us." We probably thought he's looking for an old overweight loose forward to join the squad. But and that was the start of it. And then I got really motivated. I got really strong again. I managed to then, I suppose, fight my way into the Sharks team starting lineup, and we lost in the last minute of the Super Rugby to a Great Bulls team, and because of that, I think I got selected for the box that year. So very privileged.
So there was never a conversation between you and Jake White leading up to 07 about you coming home and maybe making the World Cup squad.
No, I mean, I think, remember Percy Montgomery had been at the Dragons team with me, and he was in comms with Jake, and he'd sort of, and at those days you couldn't be playing overseas. I mean, remember all the players after 95 and even 98, Joel Stransky went overseas, a lot of guys went to Bedford, Rudolph went there, guys played internationally, but we didn't see them. It wasn't on TV. I mean, not like these days. You can play for flipping Leinster and you turn up for the books. I mean, it's flipping awesome, So overseas was like this dark grey, misty place that you don't see anything happen. And once I'd gone, I suppose I'd gone, and it was just because Dick Muir and the Sharks coaching team had come to England to talk to some of the coaches and see the setups, that they saw me playing for England against the Barbados. I mean, literally, that was the reason. And I think when they reached out, it might have been, in conjunction with Jake saying, "Well, if we get this guy, would you help?" Because South African rugby accepted me back into the fold quite quickly, so I was very lucky.
How cool was it that you got to captain your country again at that World Cup in 07?
Yeah, it was a great privilege. I had two World Cups. Like I said, the one I was young and dumb and probably seen as not deserving of being there, although I was quite comfortable in my position. And 2007 was a great privilege. I made a lot of friends. I think I contributed a lot more. I was more than happy to carry bags, to be motivational on the side. I captained the team in two of the matches, which I absolutely loved. And I was there all the way up until the semi-final. I didn't play in the final, but I was never going to play in the final if we played against England. I was going to play if we played against France, because we had two different squads. Wikus van Heerden and I shared that sort of extra loose forward position. And Jake said to me, if England beat France, then Wikus is going to play, which I accepted. As a younger player, I would have been much more disappointed, but just to be there was amazing. And then, life comes in fits and starts. My son was born that week. And I'd had a daughter, but I didn't have a son. So I look back on that memory as incredibly fond, as part of my collection of memories of rugby.
That's very cool. My second daughter was actually born, I think it was 3 days before the 2023 semi-final against England. And I always tell people both my daughters have never known a world in which the Springboks are not the world champions. That's
Well, there
something
you go,
quite cool.
exactly.
Bobby, I want to ask you this. I know that, like you said, you didn't actually get to play in the final, but what did it feel like when the referee blew the final whistle and you were a world champion?
Oh, incredible. Amazing to be there. My mum came over for the match. And like I said, my wife had been in hospital basically with our second child. So I didn't have that much family around, but then I saw her, hugged her. I was very close to a lot of members of the team, and it was a great privilege to be there. Butch James and I were roommates, and he knew that I had his back in anything that he needed that week, and he was a big part of why and how we won that World Cup. He was accurate in his defense. He was incredible in his motivation of the players. John Smith's obviously a great friend, and he was brilliant. Victor and Bucky's were world class. It was great to have had we had Skulk back, because remember, he'd been out for the tackle in the Samoa game. And you know, I think we're incredibly lucky. We had an amazing team. Brian and myself got very close. Monty had come back into the scene, and he was just so accurate off the tee. He turned himself into a world champion goal kicker that carried the Springbok for a long time. So I look back on it very, very fondly, and I loved being part of that team, and I was very lucky. So I thank my lucky stars that the Springboks journey has included me just for a little bit.
So, who was your toughest opponent?
As a team, I mean, I think always playing against the All Blacks is the toughest. I enjoyed beating them at home, which not a lot of people have done. England actually ended up being a difficult team in our sort of probably middle of my career. You know, they were a tough side under Clive Woodward. They were hard to beat. I had respect for them because of the way they played, and they were gritty, and they ground out victories. Nasty guys to play against, but they've become, I mean, a lot of them have gone on and had some off-field troubles as we've seen. But you know, maybe there was an indication of the type of hard, uncompromising characters that they were. So they were a tough team. I'd say those two were definitely the toughest to beat.
When you look around today, is there a particular player that you admire?
Oh, there's lots of players that I admire. I love the speed and the skill sets of the young loose forwards who are coming through. You know, for me to see guys moving into the Springbok fold that are being able to not only carry the ball and tackle like some of the greatest players that I've seen play their game, but then also offload at speed, you know, create nice passes, look after the ball in the tackle and go forward. So I think those are all hugely sort of useful attributes, and we've got, geez, we've just got basket loads of loose forwards coming through.
Is there a particularly funny moment that you can share with us from your time with the Springboks?
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of things that stick out. The one thing that my biggest mistake was funny. We played against England in 1998, and you know, like I said, I didn't mind carrying bags and that. I was on the bench, so we were carrying the tackle bags. But you don't put your jersey on, you know, when you're in your tracksuit and you've got a t-shirt, because, you know, otherwise you're getting sweaty and hot, and we had some undershirts. It was cold and raining in Newlands. I was carrying the bag, and Andre Fenter always used to like hitting the bags and getting himself, you know, into like a physical state of readiness before the match. So I used to help him with that, and he smashed the bag, you know, a number of times. And we stayed up we had an indoor warm-up room because it was pouring with rain outside, and we stayed up there until the last minute. And I was a bit late for the team talk, so I got downstairs, zipped up and listened in, and then went outside. And I think it was Craner Otto cut his leg open. And Nick Mallett said, "Okay, Bob, you're on." And I stood up and I unzipped, and I still had my t-shirt on. My jersey was hanging in the change room wall. So I had to go to get the team manager to go and unlock the change room. So you can imagine every second now is making a difference. And Mallett's going, "Where's Bob?" And guys are going, "I don't know." And then I come sprinting out of the tunnel with my jersey on, throwing my tracksuit behind me. So I got in big trouble with the fines committee after that match. But certainly that's one that stands out.
I can just imagine. And then, Bobby, finally, what are you up to these days?
Well, I'm a full-time consultant. I work at a business called Elixir. We've got offices. We're headquartered in London, but we've got offices all over the world. I've been through a sort of a journey of venture capital, family office, and now into a consultancy. I love it to bits. The South African founder, and we do a lot of work with businesses that are going through transformation, you know, change management, that kind of thing. We've supporting different businesses to complement what we've got, and one of them is a leadership business. So I do a bit of work with the senior consultants in the leadership space with businesses around the world. And I don't know if you heard, but I recently was part of a group of people who bought into a French rugby club. So that is very much weekends only, because they play usually on a Friday night. And our business actually looks at that. The levers, you know, ticketing, e-commerce, how to fix that business. And we do it with the youngsters in our business and make sure that we are sharp and on the edge of being ready for big changes, big decisions, which is great fun. So those things preoccupy my time. And I'm lucky to have four little scallywag children from 18 down to 10, and a loving family environment. And I'm in Cape Town for Christmas this year.
Sounds good to me. Bobby, it was lovely talking to you on Front Row Rugby today, and I really hope that we can have you on again in the future.
No problem. Thanks very much for having me. Appreciate it. Go Bucks. I think the guys are doing exceptionally well. The back Rassie and the team and Tia and everybody 100% of the time.